This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
So welcome to our Adult Formation Hour here at St. David's. So we start a new series today called Nitro Theology or Cold Brew Theology. And the idea is that several years ago, churches started doing what they called theology on tap. Do you remember that? They would meet in a pub and have a beer and talk about theology. Well, I didn't think it'd be all that great to have beer this morning, or during the 10 o'clock hour at St. David's. And so I thought, well, what about cold brew coffee? We could still gather and have some cold brew and talk some theology. So that's the reason for the cold brew. So I hope you'll enjoy a can or enjoy some if you'd like. There's regular coffee out there as well. So what we'll be doing is just engaging in some different theological topics, some topics that I think are very current to our culture, our time, our world right now, topics that sometimes aren't so easy to talk about. So today we have Dr. Tony Baker with us, and he is no stranger to many of us, and he is on faculty at Seminary of the Southwest. He is the Clinton S. Quinn Professor of Systematic Theology. He's also theologian in residence at St. Julian's Episcopal Church here in Austin. And Tony has studied and written and presented in this area of ecology and Christian holiness. And so today he's going to lead us in thinking about and having a conversation about theology and species loss. And I scheduled Tony for this particular Sunday because we also have a creation care fair going on out in the surface lot. So if you're inspired from this presentation this morning, then go out to the surface lot and find out more about how you can be engaged in making a difference in the environment. So Tony, come and share your wisdom with us.
Thank you so much, Mona. It's great to be back with you all. I'll say that when I saw the name for the series, I had to think about it for a minute because I saw the brew theology and my brain went to 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning. Oh, cold brew. That's a different kind of thing. Always great to be here and see so many familiar faces. I was confirmed at St. David's. 20 years ago, about. I was married at St. David's 5 years ago, and so I was thinking that if I can manage to have a funeral at St. David's, that'd be like a hat trick, you know, sacramental hat trick. So maybe I need to look into that. I do really appreciate just an invitation to be back and talking with you all. As Mona said, one of the things that I've been working on the last few years, connected with some teaching I'm doing at the seminary, is the meeting place of theology and ecology, especially reflecting on the Christian call to holiness and what that might mean with the way that we engage with the natural world around us. So one of the questions that I've been wrestling with is one of the ones that I suggested as a conversation today, and I'm hoping we get a little bit of time for some question and answer. There's aspects of this that many of you will know more about than I do. My lifelong pursuit has been in theology, and I've been studying some biology and conservation and some of that research that's new for me, but some of you will know more about that that world. And so, as we have time for it, I would love for some interaction, some ideas, some wisdom, some question and answer. Mona, where did you go? Okay. When we do that in here, can you just sort of call out things, or does it need to be mic'd? Okay. So if you have some input, when it's time for that, we can either, do you just walk up to the mic? Is that the way to do it?
Okay, that's the way we'll do it. There you are. Hi. I went rogue there for a moment. Sorry. Theology and Species Loss, and I'm going to have to remember to do this twice. So this is, we are, I think, 2 days out of the celebration of St. Francis, which is a traditional time for blessing of the animals, for conversations about the relation of the faith that we live to the broader world of non-human animals. So I think I imagine part of what's going on with the Creation Care Fair outside, and part of the idea of making this the focus of this conversation today. I just want to point out to you, some of you know, but the famous hymn, Canticle of St. Francis, Canticle to Brother Sun and Sister Moon, the hymn that we sing, we often sing it on St. Francis Day, All Creatures of Our God and King. That's an adaptation of St. Francis of Assisi's hymn, Brother Sun, Sister Moon. And it's got that wonderful beginning, which is a kind of a theme of what I want to talk about today. All creatures of our God and King, lift up your voice and with us sing Alleluia. This is not just recognizing, this is not just Francis saying, look at all the beautiful creatures out there. He's actually inviting them to something. He's inviting them to sing, to use their voices, to sing a hymn along with him. And I think that's a beautiful and sort of theologically deep idea that's written right into that first line of the hymn. Lift up your voice and with us sing. What would that mean? What would that mean for us to engage with the created world around us in a way that invited that world to lift up their voices and sing with us? So, theology and species loss, or extinction. It's a sort of a big, somber word to be working with, but it's an important one for us to be, I think, thinking about. There's a lot of conversation about, as we engage with conversation about loss of biodiversity, all the many effects of acidification of oceans, global warming. Losing creatures is just an important reality in our era for us to consider. And what I want to do is consider it not just as humans who consume the news, humans who know something about, some humans who pay attention to issues of biology, but also as people of faith. What does it mean as people of faith to encounter this reality that we are losing species? First question is actually a more complicated question than it might seem. Just, what is a species? How do we think about different kinds of creatures, living creatures, plants and animals? How do we think about the different sorts, the different kinds? In some ways, as we know, because we have at least a cursory understanding of evolution, we know that kinds aren't stable. They're not like what we see in front of us when we see the pig or the orchid is something that's come to be and something that's in a process of change. So one contemporary biological philosopher, Deborah Bird Rose, says, rather than simply think of it as a stable kind, what if we thought of a species as a kind of knot of embodied time? So this has a long temporal history. It's been something else. It's going to become something else. But at this moment, here's the shape of what it is. It's sort of a knot in its linear progression. And we can look at the knot, and we can look at this thing that's solidified in a particular way in this moment. Some other important things though to think about when we're talking about a specific species is that it's easy to think about, I think it's my default to think about, well, the species is the whole big group, and then the pigs, the orchids, the ones inside those groups, those are members of that big group. But actually, if you're thinking about a species as a kind of knot of embodied time, they're actually participants in crafting what that very group means. the things that that individual pig finds to eat, the ways that it interacts with its environment, the way that the orchid attracts the insect. That's shaping and crafting actually what that species is and what that species could become. And that's picking up a particular inheritance from what that species has been. So rather than just sort of stable groups with members, I want to think about species as a kind of moment in a linear temporal progression where each individual is a kind of crafting member of that guild, so to speak. And another important part of this, I'm sort of reflecting on it already as we're looking at like the insect in the orchid or the foraging pigs out looking for something to eat, those members who are participants in their species, they're constantly in conversation with their environment. So a species isn't just a thing that exists in a place. It's a kind of language experiment. What if I were this? What if I tried this? What if I ate this? And that those sorts of reaching out into their environment are going to shape what that thing becomes over time. And one more just fascinating bit about what makes a species, what a species is. We tend to think, even a lot of evolutionary biologists think of survival of a species as the kind of the absolute thing that a species and the members of the species are shooting for. Everything I do is about survival. Well, in a sense, that's true. But in another sense, there's some real excesses that seem to be beyond that. And if you think about sexual selection. So sexual selection is the way that biologists will talk about not just what your genes are doing, but how mates find one another. And think about the classical, ridiculous example of the peacock. Like, there's some real excess going on there. My wife Stephanie and I were down in Colombia a couple of years ago, and we went to a sanctuary for this particular kind of bird that exists only there, and it's called a rock hen, right? Rock hen? Gallina de roca, is that what it was? Yeah, rock hen. And these birds, the male of these species have, I don't even know how to describe it, just these huge sort of helmets, bright red, and they just sort of sit on top of their heads, and they sing this loud squawking music, and they all come back and they roost in this place. And you look at this and you think, this is not sort of, if this is all about survival, there's sort of an efficiency issue here. There's gotta be a simpler way. And there's a sort of excess a demand to be recognized that becomes part of that sexual game. It becomes part of that mating and survival story. But just that affirmation of here's who I am, here's the song that I sing, here's the giant red rock that I wear on my head, here's my display of feathers. All that is a kind of, there's a kind of musicality or something to that. This challenge, almost a challenge, see if you can not acknowledge me. See if you can not notice that I'm here. And I want to say that there's, I'll circle back to it, but I think that there's something really theologically rich about that kind of excess that we see in so many species. I mean, and orchid is a great example too. Orchids are my favorite flowers. And I love the variety, the multiplicity of them, but also there's that kind of just a demand to be noticed. And this is part of what attracts. This is part of what brings the insects in. Let me see if I can just sort of put on this ridiculous display of color and petals and folds and flowers that are even hard to describe, like this, like the one in the image here. So I want to think that a species isn't just a sort of survival machine. I want to think that a species is also a kind of music, a kind of communication with the world that wants to be acknowledged. If that's what a species is, what's extinction? Now, this is another one that seems like it's pretty simple. It's when a thing goes away. I want to challenge the way that we think about extinction in a couple of different ways. First of all, when I say it, you probably think of things like the Western black rhino, the big stories of extinction. The dramatic animals that have gone from the zoos or are preserved in the zoos as long as they can be preserved in the zoos because they're gone from their natural habitats. Those are important examples of extinction, but for every one of those, there's thousands of others that are much less visible to us, like the splendid poison frog. So frogs emerged pretty much in their speciation as they exist now, basically right after the dinosaurs disappeared, right after what most people agree was a giant asteroid 66 million years ago that hit the Earth. That's one of the things that opened the door for multiplication of amphibians. And thousands of species of frogs began to inhabit the world. And most of them have existed more, that they're not of embodied time. It's pretty much existed in a stable form for about that long, for 60 million years or so. When one of them disappears, which is happening at an alarming rate right now, like the splendid poison frog, which I think was about 5 years ago, the last of this species, as far as we can tell, disappeared. That's an enormous history. It is splendid. Look at the thing. Look at the colors on the thing. This is sort of the song that it was singing out into creation. There's a loss there. It's gone. This ancient, more than ancient, pre-ancient, 60 million year old song that this particular being was speaking and the participants in that species were singing, that's now not heard, not seen, not observed, not interacting with the world anymore in any at all. And then another way that I want to challenge, so one challenge is there's the big and dramatic, but there's also the sort of the small and the less visible. And another challenge to the way that we think about extinction, we often think about extinction as when the last one goes. That's when you actually officially, you know, stamp it as this, the Western black rhino extinct, splendid poison frog extinct. Indian vultures are not totally extinct, but they are disappearing in a way that is having an enormous impact on the ecosystems in which they came to be. And I think this is an important part of the extinction story, because a species is not just a specimen that we catalog, but again, it's knot of embodied time that interacts with the world around it in ways that shape itself and that shape the world around it. So the Indian vulture emerged in as with the, you know, evolved probably from a bird of prey. It lost the ability for precision of eyesight and for precision in its flying that birds of prey need. But as it did so, it adapted external and internal abilities to scavenge, to eat dead things. And obviously, this plays a very important part in ecosystems. And even human ecosystems in India have taken shape with the awareness of this bird. And so the burial practices, the disposing of the dead, animals and humans, has taken shape over the centuries with the recognition that there are scavenger birds that not only can consume rotting flesh that other creatures can't, but they can also do things like consume diseased flesh and things like anthrax. When anthrax grows up through fungi in the ground and inhabits these bodies, almost anything that eats it will be poisoned and killed, but not the Indian vulture. And they can consume and dispose of things like anthrax in their bodies. Well, with the with development, with lot for various reasons, human development, but also various reasons, these vultures are going what we call you can call locally extinct, regionally extinct in the places where they existed, and that's changing the ecosystems there. For one of the things that's happening is wild canines are increasing. Wild canines that can eat dead flesh, they can't eat it, and it will poison them. Rabies is becoming a major factor in some of these towns where it never was before, because you've got diseased rabid dogs. That's changing what it means to be a human in these places. So I want us to think about extinction not just as it's super sad when the last one goes, but if these are historical beings that interact with their environment, as they begin to disappear, everything changes. Changes in just becomes unstable in new ways that impact the whole ecosystem around them. So there we are, defining terms. A book that many of you probably know, if you don't, a very good one. This is not written by a professional conservationist, biologist, scientist, but a journalist who knows the science really well, and Elizabeth Colbert, and she writes a book called The Sixth Extinction. And the thesis of this is that there have been through the history of the planet, there have been five major extinction events. And what's happening now, as a result of the one particular mammal that has inhabited the globe and spread out, there's another major extinction event that's underway. She's a very funny writer, along with telling a sad story. She's a very funny writer. She constantly is saying, this weedy species called humans, and noticing what is taking over. So just a few of the sad realities that she talks to us about. Usually, there's something called background rate of extinction. As life branches out and explores different paths and tries different things, and as the individuals that are the participants are trying different things, branching into different species, some of them get lost. Some of them just don't survive for various reasons. And we call this a kind of background rate of extinction. All factors being equal, probably an amphibian will disappear about every 1,000 years. And probably a mammal will disappear about every 600-700 years. It's amazing. Like, that's the normal extinction rate. It's amazing how long these things continue to sort of survive and keep attempting to find their niche within these ecosystems. Right now, we are losing, if my math is right, I think we are losing 45 amphibians a year, which is 45,000 times the normal extinction rate. We are in danger, she tells us, likely on a trajectory to lose about a third of the reef-producing corals, a fourth of the mammals, a fifth of our reptiles, and one-sixth of our birds. So that's the kind of extinction event that she's talking about. And just to give you a fun little graph to show where we are here, these are marking, I know it's hard to see, you can't read the fine print, but you can sort of see the big breaks. These are marking the previous five. The first from most likely a major glaciation event, you can see these, but they can track these by digging into the strata of the Earth. A major glaciation event, the next one probably just by the birth of trees. As trees begin to grow, send roots into the ground, it changed the Earth's atmosphere. The makeup of carbon and oxygen, carbon dioxide and oxygen changed, and the oceans sort of begin to suffocate, and many things begin to die off. Then you get the probably both the third and the fourth, the Permian-Triassic extinction and the Triassic-Jurassic extinction, probably volcanic activity were the big culprits there. This little detail here says 96% of all life on Earth perished. That's amazing. That's the big one right here. Extinction event number three. And then the fifth one is the most famous one. That's where the T-Rexes left the Earth. And that one comes so abruptly that we're fairly certain it tracks to a major asteroid that hit the Yucatan Peninsula about 66 million years ago and changed the makeup of the atmosphere, blocked out the sun and changed the nature of the atmosphere, and killed 60 to 76% of all life on the planet, but allowed frogs to take over. And then the sixth one is the one that we're in the midst of now, sometimes called the Holocene extinction, sometimes called the Anthropocene extinction. Some of you have heard that phrase. The theory there is that we are now in a new epoch, and the epoch is constituted mostly by how humans are reshaping the planet. So the Anthropocene, for that word, Anthropos, human. So the Anthropocene extinction. Now, one of the things that we tend to talk about when we're talking about extinction is the sad loss of biodiversity. And the loss of biodiversity is sad. And as biologists and conservationists are paying attention to that language and paying attention to the way that ecosystems actually work, they're noting some trouble with that language. We can tend to say, well, the whole problem of extinctions is we lose biodiversity and things, we need to maximize biodiversity in ecosystems. One of the problems with this is that it can, overemphasis on biodiversity can reduce species to numbers. Like what's the count of the biodiversity of that region? Is it, I don't even know how you count biodiversity, but let's say it's like 100 species per square foot. I don't know. But if the count is important, then it's not so much who's there, what's there, what they're doing with the environment. It's just, well, we got to get those numbers up. You know, it's like we're giving them a grade. We got to get the A. And if you think back to our sort of theological charge at the beginning from St. Francis, that doesn't sound like Francis saying, hey, all creatures, lift up your voice and sing with me. It's just like, I'm not even actually paying attention to what their voices say. I'm just saying, how many are there? So that's one of the issues with biodiversity. It can translate life into numbers in a way that's not entirely helpful. Another problem with biodiversity is it can tend to give us the assumption that life is harmonious and stable. And turns out it's not. Turns out just like a species is a kind of knot of, what did I say? A temporal knot of something, I forgot the term. Knot of embodied time. Just as a species is a knot of embodied time, so is an ecosystem. And there are periods of stability. And then there are periods of violence. There are periods of real upheaval, of invasion. Even that language that we use about invasive species, that's complicated language. Because it's often very helpful language, but it can be complicated language in the sense that the stabilized ecosystems that we see got that way from invasive species. From things, you know, animals finding their way in, plants finding their way in, and then lots of takeover and lots of turf war, and then here come these pieces, these moments of stability in the midst of it, before the next thing comes in and something new happens. So biodiversity can sort of can give us a kind of sense of a snapshot. If we just like here's what this place wants to be always and forever, and turns out life doesn't work that way. Life is this sort of dialectic of stability and instability. And so that's an important thing to remember. Well, all of this that I've been saying sort of complicates this whole question of extinction. One of the things that it complicates, that does so complicate our notion of extinction, is first of all just to say that when so many things are going extinct, we have to make choices about which ones matter more to us than others. Saving one species will probably mean allowing others to go extinct. That's just complicating things. A kind of moral impulse to say all extinction must be stopped. Well, that's never been the case. There's always been kind of background species who are not hanging on. And then there are natural events that even the big ones, even the big mass extinctions, there's nothing you can do if an asteroid hits the Yucatan, or a volcanic eruption changes the makeup of the atmosphere, or if trees suffocate the ocean life. We can't fight that. The Earth could never fight that. So even though I feel this sense of like, oh, extinction, we've got to stop this, it's complicated for those reasons. Extinction itself is morally neutral. It's part of a rhythm of life. And then there's this question about what motivates our anxiety, or for some people, our active participation in trying to work against extinction, whether it's as a career, or whether it's through donations funding, or whether it's through education, what it's from. And I'm including myself here. I'm motivated to talk about these things. What's motivating me? And one motivation likely is guilt. This is the Anthropocene extinction. It's not an asteroid that hit the Yucatan. It's what I drive to work. So some scientists have said when you picture the agents of the Anthropocene extinction, just picture somebody driving to work in a Honda. Like that's actually more than anything else. It's just how humans have inhabited the globe. And that's not an intention. That's not like, can't wait to kill all the things on my way to work today. It's just me being here doing this means that other things can't be. So do I own some guilt around this? Is that a motivation? Am I motivated by cuteness? How are we going to choose which animals count and which ones don't? You probably, not too many people are super worried about
Cockroaches.
What if there's a variety of the cockroach that we're going to lose forever and ever? Robin's not going to carry that flag and say, let's stop the, you know, before we lose the cockroach. It's cuteness. You know, there's that, I'm going to say something else about this in a second, but there is that sort of awe factor. Like, if it makes me say, aww, that's going to be part of what motivates me. I think there's something biological, maybe even theological about that. We'll come back to it. Then there's this other factor, and this was the recent article in The Atlantic acknowledged that extinction's complicated in all these reasons. And the conclusion of the article, which I found to be very unsatisfying, was we can't stop extinction from happening. We could never stop it. We can't stop it now. But we do need to worry about our own vulnerability as a species. So our ethical sort of framework needs to be, what species do we need to keep from going extinct in order to assure that we don't go extinct? That's important, I get it. And I also feel like that doesn't feel good enough to me, because I don't want to have to sort of do that math and figure out, should I care? It just feels like there's something else I might want to be asking myself. I don't want us to go extinct. I'm real sure about that. But I don't want that to be the only thing that I feel like it's hard to sing Francis' hymn, "All creatures of our God and King, lift up your voice and with us sing," if that's all I'm saying. Then I'm saying, "All creatures of our God and King, if you can keep me alive, sing with me. If you can't, I don't care." I think that's what I'm noticing. That in itself may not be a full and satisfying way of engaging with this dilemma of extinction. I want to think a bit, so kind of keeping that Francis framework in mind, think a bit about the beginning of John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Logos. I'm using the Greek word there, just that we translate as word. In the beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. All things came into being through him, and without him not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life. So this is the Gospel of John's launch, and it launches by saying, the old word is midrash, a kind of riff on the Genesis story. So John has read the Genesis story. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And John says, pause, I'm gonna open that up a little bit. In the beginning, when God was doing that creating of the heavens and the earth, the Word was with God. In fact, the Word was God. The Word was with God in the beginning, and all the heavens and earth that came to be through that Word, that Logos. And that word that gave everything, that called everything to be, what came to be was life. So I think what that invites us to do is to sort of see the creation story as God's language just said in a million different ways throughout creation. And I've forgotten the term again. I keep doing this. Those knots of embodied time. That's language. That's divine language. That's, you know, think of it maybe as a sort of poem. Think of it as a kind of part in a symphony. But somehow the notes that this thing, or the words, the syllables that this thing pronounces, that's who it is. That's it pronouncing the language that God has spoken into being from the very beginning. And I think this is the way that, of course, John understands the person of Jesus. This is what he's talking about here. This is, Jesus is the Word, that Word of creation made flesh. So the presence of Christ in the world is the ultimate Word of God that all creation finds itself in. And this is what makes this story so strange for John, because the next verse here says, "He came to that which was his own, and his own knew him not." The composer walking among the symphony, and the symphony saying, the instruments themselves saying, "Who's that? No idea. What's he doing here? He's out of place." Or the poet, you know, walking in the midst of his own language, and the very words being like, "No, no idea. No idea who that is." So this is the strangeness of John's Gospel, is the Word itself comes to be among all that which it spoke into existence, and it knew him not. One of the ancient church fathers who talked about this is St. Gregory of Nyssa. And he's working with both that Genesis story and the John story. And he says, what God is doing is God is placing his words, uses the plural there, logoi. He places his logoses. He places his words in them, and that's what they are. Things emerge as these words. But then he wonders, how do I actually hear the divine words spoken in the beings around me? When I see the orchid, he says, I see that I can use my senses, I can smell, I can see, I can watch what happens in the environment around it. I can feel the texture. I'll invite that embodied being to tell me something about what what word God was saying, God is saying, as God pronounces this word that becomes orchid. He says one of the things that this leads him to believe, and this is connecting to that evolutionary idea. God's logos is dunamis, another Greek word, or God's word is dynamic. It's not just a static thing spoken and there, zebra, said that. But just as that word is sort of hard to discern, what is God saying here? Part of what makes it hard is that the word is constantly changing. The church fathers, I think, across the board would have been fascinated by Darwin's theory of evolution. I think it would have just seemed obvious to them when he said, like, oh yeah, I don't know why we hadn't seen it that way. Because for them, this change, the idea that God's word is going to continue to take shape and continue to change, that just makes perfect sense to them. God is beyond time. God's word is beyond time. When God speaks that word into creation, that word's going to take shape dynamically through time, constantly changing, constantly adapting. What Gregory is inviting us to here, then, is a kind of contemplation of the divine word as it's spoken in these creatures. You might even think of it as a kind of lectio divina. The medieval church especially like to talk about God's two books. There's the book of scripture, and there's the book of the world. There's the book of nature. And they're saying the same thing. It's just that we don't know how to read the book of nature anymore. So God said, I better give them a book with words and pages. But they're really just trying to tell us the same thing. And in the same way that we contemplate the words of scripture and find out what God is saying to us, Gregory's saying, we ought to be able to contemplate the orchid and hear what God is saying to us. How can we do a kind of lectio divina of the natural world around us? I think we do have a few minutes here. So, two examples. One very familiar to you, one probably not as familiar to many of you. One is the whooping crane that some of you have seen down in Port Aransas, which has become an important region for preserving this species. And it's been a very complex journey for rescuing this species. I think at one point there were 20 whooping cranes left in the world, maybe about 80 years ago. And through remarkable, often very invasive efforts by scientists and conservationists, people have imitated whooping crane parents and dressed up as whooping cranes and gotten the newborns to imprint on them so that they could teach them, and then gotten in motorized gliders and become flying whooping cranes and shown them the migratory paths, taught them where to go. Anybody been to Port Aransas to see the whooping cranes? A few of you. So what I'd love to know, if you have a thought about it, is what, just from what you have observed, if you've ever done any if you've seen them, or just thinking about the story that I'm telling you now, what might God have been saying in a very unique way when God pronounced the word that became whooping cranes? Mm-hmm. While you're thinking about that one, I'll give you the other one. So these are the little penguins, the smallest species of penguins that exist in a particular coast of Australia. And these guys are endangered because of development along the coastline. And what's remarkable about these little guys is they have what conservationists call sight fidelity. They, not this kind of sight, but like location kind of sight. In the same way that many species will imprint on a parent, they also imprint on a place. And so when they come to their nesting ground is the same place they have always come to. And they don't really have they don't have any capacity to diverge. And so when that becomes built up with beach homes and hotels and beach walls and things, they just show up anyway. Like, well, let's see, where can we nest around here? And they'll start nesting under boats, they'll start crawling under swimming pools, sort of, you know, making places to nest. People and penguins don't exist all that well together. People walk their dogs on the beach, and that's not good for little penguins. And so they're endangered because of that development. One of the fascinating parts of their story is there was a major oil spill off the coast of Australia in this region where they come to nest. And the conservationists knew nothing was going to stop them. They're going to swim right through that oil. So they took them, and they somehow rounded them up, and they took them like 700 miles away and planted them on a beach, and then just left them alone. Because they knew they were going to go back. They just needed more time to clean up the oil first. So they get to working and cleaning and cleaning and cleaning, and eventually here they come, you know. Oh, it was a longer trip this time, but we made it, you know. So site fidelity is one of the fascinating things about these penguins. Anybody have any ideas about what, do some lexio contemplation here. All creatures of our God and sing, lift up your voice and with us sing. All of our God and King, lift up your voice and with us sing. What might God have been saying in the species that became either the little penguins or the whooping cranes?
Beauty and free-flowing spirit, exuberance and joy.
Yeah.
For the whooping crane.
Beauty, free-flowing joy. So, what I love about that is, if you take those adjectives and use them for the whooping crane, what happens when you sort of take out the whooping crane and you put the word God in there? The whooping cranes are free-flowing spirits, exuberant with joy. God is a kind of free-flowing spirit, exuberant with joy. That's what God was showing the world when God said, we're going to need whooping cranes. Yeah, I love that. What else?
Symmetry.
Symmetry.
When you look at it, you visualize the symmetry.
Yeah. So there's kind of beauty to that symmetry, right? There's kind of balance and beauty. Yeah. God said, I'm going to want to show that to the world.
For the penguins, it seems like there's a constancy, a faithfulness.
Yeah. Faithfulness. Site fidelity. It's got that word faithfulness in there. I'm loyal. I am committed. Nothing is going to diverge me from my home, the place that I love. Something about that is God saying, maybe you could learn something about my faithfulness by paying attention to those little penguins. That's the song of praise those penguins are singing. Yeah, thank you.
So,
the hummingbird like, also.
So one of the, I think, potentially controversial things that this says is it's a comment on development and about recognizing the, I'm going to just say, sanctity of natural habitats. And obviously they didn't intend to spill the oil on the beach. At least I hope they didn't, as a way to get rid of the penguins. But this notion there that it strikes me as a question is, what are naturally protected, what are the rights of non-humans in terms of protecting habitats for creatures who are part of diversity? Well, we've obviously said we don't like biodiversity necessarily as a sort of a value, but okay.
I mean, I don't like biodiversity.
Yeah, but in terms of like, you know, that the whole earth is humans, is belongs to us for whatever we want to use it for,
right.
Which to me is in some ways kind of sacrilegious. So it's an interesting question, I guess, just in terms of when land gets developed for land use by people who are unhoused, or, you know, those questions come into being in terms of, doesn't every human deserve a place to live? Yeah. Well, what about species who you're going to displace by creating those environments?
Yeah, those are really ethically complicated questions, and I think they need to be ethically complicated. I think that it's important to acknowledge that we often find ourselves with competing goods, and it's not simply that, you know, one ethical position is going to say, I care about, you know, this, I care about what this development could bring to this community, and I guess the other people just don't. Because often it's the other people saying, well, I care, there's something else that I'm worried about. And those competing goods are often what put us at odds with one another. Almost always what puts us at odds with one another. And I think in this conversation, that's a really, really important thing to wrestle with. There's no simple answer to that one. And I think part of what I want you to hear me say this morning is that this is not a simple issue. This is not like, well, if we could just make the obvious right choice, we would, because sometimes it's not clear. That's true. I'll move us on. I think we may have a minute or two more at the end, but... This is Bing Bong from Inside Out, and I could have used lots of examples, but Bing Bong's a fantastic one. If we've ever watched Disney or Pixar movies, we know that we love cute, cuddly animals. That's just a thing about us. And Bing Bong's got this great line, and so Bing Bong's an imaginary friend in Inside Out. And he's an imaginary friend that was created when the child was about 3 years old. And somebody asks him, like, I don't even get it, what are you? He says, well, I'm part elephant, I'm part raccoon, and I'm part dolphin. And so, like, I don't actually see the dolphin, but he sort of, you know, it's, I think he sort of does a dolphin pose or something. See, I'm dolphin too. And also mostly made of cotton candy. He describes this as, he says, well, you got to remember, when the kid was 3 years old and she invented me, animals were all the rage. That's all anybody talked about. Animal songs, animal books, that's all that we talked about. Another of my favorite from I don't remember, Disney or Pixar, I get them confused, but from the Despicable Me, when the... one of the kids gets this giant, fluffy toy from a fair, and she's like just overwhelmed by how soft and cute this is. And she says, oh, it's so fluffy, I wanna die. That's like cute and funny to us because we get it. Like, there is something about this awe factor, you know, that wells up in us. And there's actually some good scientific research on this. Biologically, there's a pretty well-respected theory. It's developed mostly by famous theorist E.O. Wilson, who says that we have evolved, humans have evolved, to love, empathize with, be curious about, desire connections with the life forms around us. And part of this just has to do with the need for empathy. So, quick evolution of human story. Part of what happened when our brains grew big is that we stood up on two legs, and the largeness of the brain meant that these babies needed to come out in what in other mammals would be premature, because it's just the head's growing too fast and it's not going to be able to, the birth isn't going to work. So we had, in terms of sort of the broad scope of the mammalian world, human babies are premature. They don't, I mean, think about like, if you think about what like on a farm, first thing that happens is the calf stands up and starts walking around. Well, that's going to take a long time for a human. This human's going to be real soft, real vulnerable, need total care for a long time, and then gradually taper off until the thing is actually able to walk around and totter, and eventually, when they're like 27, like find food for themselves and all of that. This takes a while. Well, part of the theory is we needed to develop a deep empathy for vulnerable things so that we could care for our premature babies well. And that's this sort of, that's our draw to soft and cuddly. We need to want to do this with soft, cuddly things. Because otherwise, we're going to see those babies born and say, is it going to do anything? Is it going to, you know, aren't you hungry? But that impulse for deep empathy, even the sort of the big eyes, you know, the puppy eyes, that's also sort of wired into us as sort of like, oh, I can feel the feelings that this vulnerable creature is feeling. Look, it's all coming through the ribosome. It needs me to take care of it. Well, that's part of, you know, that we have evolved that way so that we can actually care for our young. I want to say also there's some theological sense to that. That not only have we evolved that way, but we've been created that way. Our particular line within creation, our particular noctem embodied time, God at that time. What if our unique role in creation is to love God's language in its countless expressions? What if that's what we do with that biological sense of empathy for other creatures? Our desire to connect with them, our desire to hold them and cuddle them. What if we say, actually, this is our unique role. We can do what, as far as we know, other animals can't do. We can listen for and empathize with the deep call of God that is that creature and not others. Now, there is some empathy that we see in other creatures, and this is really fun to notice. Like stories about when the mother gorilla at the zoo picks up a human child that's fallen and takes care of it. That's the building blocks of what we have. That's what we're seeing it in the animal kingdom there, which is an amazing thing to see emerge. But this is what I want to suggest to us, that this is what's going on with that urge within us, that we are experiencing ourselves as the creatures God made us to be, which includes inviting all the creatures around us to lift up their voices and sing with us. What would it mean if we're listening for God's language in the expressions of the world around us? So, George Williams, conservationist, says that the loss of, for instance, he just picks a couple, loss of Steller's sea cow, which is about a 300-year-old extinction, and the Adam and Eve orchid. This one's a little funny, I think. I think maybe that one didn't go entirely extinct. He wrote this about 30 years ago. I think this one came back, but he thought it was extinct. The loss of Steller's sea cow and the Adam and Eve orchid were the same kind of loss to historical scholarship as the burning of the library at Alexandria. You see why he might say that? It's this vast collection of life, of language, of ideas that's birthed this kind of just ridiculous, remarkable creature that swims around the ocean, or this orchid that expresses itself in these exuberant ways that nothing else has. When that's lost, something precious and valuable that will never return has been lost. A kind of experiment of life that took thousands and thousands and millions of years, in fact, is just, it's lost. A philosopher with a fantastic name, Ted Codevine, he takes that idea and says, instead of thinking of it as a library, what if we thought of it as an entire language? the death of a language. Each species carries with it a unique reservoir of expressive possibilities. What I like about what he's saying is it's not just a collection of data. It's not just a library that's lost, but it's a living language, which means we've lost a future. We've lost the future ways that could express itself. If you think about a language, to be fluent in a language is not just to sort of be able to hear the words somebody says and answer them back, but it's also you play in a language, you tell jokes in a language, you create literature within that language, you write music in that language. To really inhabit a language is to sort of have that creative, free-flowing experiments with the people that you work with, people that you're in the group with. Even if it's just like you and your friends sitting around having a conversation, that is an absolute unique event within your language that will never happen that way again. So thinking about a species as a language in that sense is a sort of, there's an extra layer of grief there. It's not just all these things that were once said are gone, but all these possibilities of the things that could be tried out, of the ways that these beings could interact with their environment. That's actually what's lost. And then one more idea to try out with you. Some of you have heard the word solastalgia. So let me see if I can get you there. Nostalgia. We know what that is, and actually etymologically, nostalgia is simply the pain or loss of losing a home or a familiar place. That's what nostalgia is. It's got this sort of sense now of a kind of a derogatory sense of, oh, you're just sort of, you know, a silly attachment to past things. But actually, that's what it means. It means like a loss of a home. Solastalgia is a word that a conservationist philosopher from Australia has invented to say the crisis of the moment now is that even when we are home, things are unfamiliar. It's not the same, plants and animals are not around us. The landscape is changing. We feel like we're sort of, even when we're in familiar places, something feels lost and something feels gone. And he creates this word, solastalgia, for pain at the loss of the familiar, even when we're at home. So if he can create a word, I want to create a word too. And the word I want to create is logostalgia. The logos is the words that God puts within creation that get expressed in a language, streams of language that get expressed in totally unique ways. When a species is lost, that's what we're losing. We're losing logos. We're losing divine language. That for me is a sort of theological description of that pain that comes along with the dramatic ones like the black rhino. The excessive ones like the splendid poison frog, or even the just deeply ingrained ones like the Indian vulture, deeply ingrained with its ecosystem. That's what we're losing. We're losing a little bit of God's language within creation. And if that's the case, then that gives me a sense of sort of sadness, a sense of grief about Francis' hymn. When Francis calls out, all creatures of our God and King, lift up your voice and with us sing. Some of the singers are lost. Some of the voices are lost. Some of the expressions are lost. And that means that we ourselves are diminished. Back to that idea from the Atlantic that let's only worry about the ones that affect us. Well, in a sense, if this is our role in creation, to listen for the ways that God is expressed in the whooping crane and in the little penguin, if I've lost that expression, I'm losing something of my connection with God there. I don't know something about God's faithfulness. I don't know something about God's beauty. I've lost the ability to praise God for those things in that particular way because there's no more whooping crane. Now there is a whooping crane. We've worked hard at that. But for the ones that we've lost, this is what I'm saying, that we are, we're feeling that grief. We're feeling that grief because we have evolved as creatures who feel grief, and we are also feeling that grief because we were created by God as creatures who listen in, not just to the way that we express our praise to God, but we listen in to the way that other creatures around us express praise to God. Final thought, there's a very wild and remarkable poem in Anglican theological history by someone named Christopher Smart, who was in an asylum, a mental health asylum back in the 18th century. And his only companion there was his cat. And he writes a long poem on his cat, Jeffrey. And the whole gist of the poem is, I think my cat Jeffrey is praying. I'm going to study the way. I'm going to consider my cat Jeffrey and think about the ways that he bathes in the sun and takes naps and gives himself baths are actually expressing his praise and prayer to the same God that I believe in. I think that's what I'm seeing. That's what I'm noticing in this engagement of theology with species loss, is that this is the gift that the creatures of the world have to give us, and our gift back to them is that gift of acknowledging what it is we hear them saying and how it is we hear them praying and praising the God around them. Thank you.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.